This is the Commonwealth Club of California. Find us on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. I'm Ann Clark, a member of the Commonwealth Club and chair of the Environment and Natural Resources member-led forum. Our program tonight is Health and Hope, from the ocean depths to the mountain tops. And our speakers tonight are Liz Cunningham, author and environmental activist, and Arlene Blum, executive director of Green Science Policy Institute. And it is my pleasure to introduce you to Liz and have her speak, and she will be our first speaker tonight. Liz?
Thanks so much, Anne. It's a pleasure to be here. So, you know, my book, Ocean Country, is about the state of the oceans, but it's also very much about finding hope in the face of very dire environmental problems. And I especially want to thank you all for coming tonight, because if I were sitting where you're sitting, and I sat down and someone stood up and they said, you know what, I'm going to talk about hope for our environmental future, I'd kind of go like, you know, okay, all right. And, you know, I'd be very tempted to think, no matter what you say, I'm not sure I'm going to believe you. So I appreciate your curiosity and your attention. And what I want to do is tell you some stories about some of the amazing people that I met. Because I didn't find hope. I found people who showed me what hope can be. So I started my career out as an editor and a journalist covering presidential politics. And I was in a very bad kayak accident in the ocean. And after that accident, I felt like I can't go back to the life I was living. So for over a decade, I struggled with injuries for the accident, and I earned my keep as a freelance editor. But over time, I realized something. I realized that even though the ocean had, you know, almost dished me up as chum, even though it terrified me at moments, I realized I loved it. I'd always loved it. It just got stuck in the leisure compartment of my life. So I thought, hey, why don't I, you know, take my work as a writer and, you know, combine that with my love for the ocean and write about the ocean. And I was really excited about this idea. But you know how sometimes you say you're doing something for one reason? I'm doing this for yada yada reason, but there's actually another reason that's driving you. And for me, there was something else that was driving me. And I couldn't describe it. I called it this thing. It was this haunting thing that had been kind of haunting me ever since the kayak accident. And I couldn't put my finger on it, but I knew that in starting to write about the ocean, I was also trying to figure out that thing. So in 2011, I started research for this book. And I thought, you know, hey, I'm a journalist. I know what I'm doing. I had absolutely no idea what I was getting into. The first thing I had no idea I was getting into was how absolutely essential water is to almost every aspect of life on our planet. So this picture, I see this picture differently now. If you and I were standing on the moon, you know, we're standing there, and you say, hey, what's that thing over there? I'd say to you, that's ocean country. Because there is no life on our planet without water. And almost all of that water, 97%, is in the ocean. And even me, like right now, I'm breathing, you know, I'm making sure to breathe between my phrases and not worry if a cell phone rings, you know? And that breath, every breath that I take, over half of the oxygen in every breath that each of us takes comes from marine plants and algae in the ocean. So I didn't understand how the ocean is our life support system. The other thing I didn't understand was how much damage we were doing. I saw reefs with life like this in the Turks and Caicos Islands turn into this. This is coral bleaching. I traveled to West Papua New Guinea, the marine biodiversity epicenter of the world, and you'd be swimming along in a reef like this, and suddenly you get to this. This is dynamite fishing, where fishermen drop bundles of dynamite in the reef, and it obliterates the reef, it kills all the fish, and then they pick the fish up. You know, and all this time I'd been doing research and doing interviews, and people had been telling me stuff, and they kept telling me one thing repeatedly, and that is that we're on the verge of a global fisheries collapse. And, you know, yes, there are pockets of well-managed fisheries around the world, but the bottom line is we're on the verge of a global collapse. And, you know, when I'd heard things like that and when I read it, I found it somehow unbelievable. But when I was in places like this, then I thought, okay, now I believe it. Now this is real. This is a village in Southeast Asia, in Sulawesi, called Mantigola. The day I spent there was the one of the most unforgettable days of my life. I saw there how people, like many people around the world, depend on their catch from the sea to survive, and that a fish is like a unit of measure, like a potato before the Irish potato famine. Because the number of people around the world that depend on seafood as their primary source of protein, that number is over 2 billion people. The United Nations estimates it at over 2.6 billion people. And when you take that number and you put it side by side with the fact that we're on the verge of a global fisheries collapse, that is a massive crisis. Before we left the village, I was with my translator, Ricardo Saliki, and before we left the village, we stopped at this dock and we talked with these kids, and I looked into this little girl's eyes and I thought, what is your future going to be like? How are people going to eat? Because when you factor in climate change, what does it mean? It means more droughts, more severe droughts. It means more food shortages, more severe food shortages, more flooding, more cyclones. It means what I'd read, what people had told me and I'd heard. It means if you'd asked me before and you said, do you get this? Do you understand this? I'd say, yeah, I read it. And if you'd pushed me and said, do you really understand this? I would have backed up and said, no, I get it. But it did not register. It did not register the day it registered the way it did that day in that village. And what it is that we need to take decisive action, because we're on the verge of not only the greatest environmental catastrophe in history, but we're on the verge of the greatest humanitarian catastrophe in history. I took this picture when we were leaving the village. You could feel the vulnerability and the scarcity on your skin. I had been searching for hope for the ocean, for the creatures of the sea. Now I was searching for hope for humanity. But even in this place, things were starting to change. This is a fisherman named Ossie Wahab, and he and his friend Dorman had organized a fishermen's collective, and all the fishermen agreed not to dynamite fish and to only use sustainable methods. And there were a number of these collectives that had formed in this area. And I met with all the fishermen, and when Ossie Wahab explained why they had formed the collective, he said, we do this for our children. We do this so our children will have fish to eat. And he said it with such pride and dignity. But it was only a few days later that I really started to understand the depth of that dignity. And what happened was I did another interview with another former dynamite fisherman, except this time that fisherman said, I'll only speak with you anonymously. And he explained to me that if you walk away from dynamite fishing, you take a huge pay cut. Dynamite fishing pays like $85 to $170. Sustainable methods, it's like $4, $40 maybe. He explained that the bombs are dangerous. A friend had lost an arm. One friend was blinded in one eye. He explained that the dynamite, a lot of the dynamite, is black market dynamite, and it comes from a big boss in Singapore. And the dynamite and the fish run through organized crime networks that run narcotics. So when these fishermen walked away from dynamite fishing, they not only took a huge pay cut, but many of them had the pride and the courage and the dignity to walk away from organized crime. On my last day of interviews, I met with these villagers on the island of Tomia, and they too had formed a collective. And I knew I was heading back to the States, and I said to them, I said, someday I'm going to be speaking to audiences. Is there anything that you would like me to tell them? And one fisherman said, yes. He said, please tell them to eat sustainable seafood. It's not cheap. It costs more money. But if we're not willing to do this, there will be no fish left in the sea. And you know, these issues are so overwhelming. They're so huge. But you start where you are, and you start with what you care about. And I cared about the ocean, and I cared about these people. So I said, okay, all right, I'm going to make sustainable seafood a focus. My next area of research was the Mediterranean. So I went home, I started doing my preliminary research. And all these people start telling me, they're all telling me, there's this amazing woman in Paris. She's working with French chefs. And French chefs are a big deal, you know, because they have their hand on a big spigot of influence. And they can have a ripple effect all around the world. And I was like, oh, okay, all right, okay, yeah, yeah. But I kept hearing it. People kept telling me. So finally I said, okay, when I go to the Mediterranean, I'll take the train and I'll go up to Paris. And this is Elizabeth Vallée, who is the director of SeaWeb Europe. And she explained to me that if you want to make sustainable seafood work, you have to do one thing. You have to do what she called, you have to get every actor in the supply chain to engage. So she didn't just work with French chefs. She worked with fishermen and retailers and wholesalers and culinary schools. And she kept stressing one thing to me. She said, to make it work, everybody in the chain needs to be engaged. Everybody has a role to play. But she did take me to meet a French chef. And this is François Pasteur. And we went to his restaurant in the morning before it opened for lunch, and we were sitting in this little dining room. And he explained to me that he used to make this fantastically luscious bluefin burger, which is a sushi burger. And his customers adored it. And it was one of his signature dishes. But then he explained that he learned more about bluefin. He said, you know, he watched documentaries. He learned what magnificent creatures they were, that they migrate thousands of miles. But then he learned they're down 96%. And in some parts of the world, 1 or 2%. And he said to himself, he said, how can I serve this fish if it's being hunted to extinction? So in 2007, after a lot of thought, he said, that's it, no more, I'm not serving it. And at that time, there were a lot of people working to save bluefin all around the world, but the numbers just kept going down. This is that absolutely gigantic fish market in Tokyo, the one that is the size of 43 football fields. And this is frozen bluefin. The thing that drives the bluefin fishery is big money. One bluefin can sell for over $500,000. They're hunted like with these spotter helicopters and high-tech harpoons that are launched from these massive freezer boats. The black market is huge. Even the mafia is in on it. The corporate conglomerate Mitsubishi decided to buy up more bluefin and freeze it because they figured, hey, you know what? We can stockpile it, and then we can sell it for astronomical prices once it goes extinct. This was the most hopeless fishery in the world. So how do you save it? How do you get people to care about bluefin? I love this poster. It was done for WWF. I mean, how many kids fall asleep at night clutching a bluefin plush toy? I looked on Amazon, they have a 12-inch and a 16-inch. But the day that I was in Francois's restaurant, the day I was in that restaurant, that was in the fall of 2012. And that fall, something had happened. Some of the bluefin populations had stopped going down, and they ticked up a little bit. And it's like, huh? What? And I knew this when I was interviewing Francois, and I'm sitting in his restaurant, and he's very animated because we're doing an interview, and he's talking, and he's telling me stuff. He's telling me, you know, it's not just bluefin he makes his choices about. He buys local food. He works to minimize waste. He tries to have a good team spirit with his staff. And I was sitting there, and you know how, like, you're in the shower or you're driving, and suddenly you're thinking something, and you just get it? You go, oh, my God, I got it. And I was sitting there, and I was thinking, and I was looking at him, and I just went like this. I went blink. And then I went blink. All these people all around the world working to save bluefin, they just didn't know it would add up. And I interviewed one of the world's experts on bluefin, Sergey Tudela, and I asked him, I said, what happened? And he said, we didn't quit. The fishmongers who stopped selling it, the wholesalers who stopped buying it, the customers who refused to eat it, all the people were working on quota reductions, moratoriums, marine protected areas, protests, petitions, all those people, they didn't quit. And I had this reporter's notebook with me, and so I jotted something down real quick in my notebook. I jotted down, even if you can't do the math, don't quit. And then I thought, huh, I wonder, is this what's happening with our environmental future? So many people working all over the world, but will it add up? And the way this is now for me is it's like a bucket chain. It's like a bucket brigade. The efforts are linked. It's like a bucket chain. And what Elizabeth had been telling me about supply chains, that applies here in spades. Everybody in the chain needs to be engaged. Everybody has a role to play. So this is a little piece of that chain. These are some folks from the Marine Mammal Center in Sausalito, and they're releasing a sea lion that they rescued. If you ask me for the one thing that taught me the most about hope, I tell you it was contact with these people. They have over 1,000 volunteers. They treat over 1,000 animals a year. They can't save them all, no matter what they do, but they have the courage to live with that and then treat every new animal with renewed care and focus. And they brought to life, for me, the ideas of the philosopher Joanna Macy when she writes about active hope. Because she writes that hope, it's not something that you have. Hope, she writes, is something that you do. And they brought alive the ideas of David Orr when he wrote, hope is a verb with its sleeves rolled up. So I started to see this as this. These people, their sleeves are rolled up. They're not calculating the odds. They know hope's not a guarantee. But I still wondered, what drives them? What puts fire in their belly? What sustains them? And I could see, okay, the Marine Mammal Center folks, I see it. But I didn't have a way to think about it. And then I remembered something that my great uncle used to say often. And when I remembered it, it was like retrieving a long-lost puzzle piece. My great-uncle, Kurt Hahn, was the founder of Outward Bound. And when he was very old and he knew he was dying, he said one thing often to many of his colleagues. He said, "The passion for rescue releases the highest dynamic of the human soul." And when I remembered that, I realized, of course, the bucket chain, the Marine Mammal Center folks, of course. And then I realized, oh wow, the thing, the haunting, mysterious thing that just had nagged me since the kayak accident. So for a moment, let me tell you what happened in that accident. I was out in the surf in a whitewater kayak, and I was surfing waves, and I was having a gas. And I got hit by a huge rogue wave and had a concussion. And when I came to, I was upside down with my head facing the bottom of the ocean. And to get yourself out of a kayak, you have to take your arms and release this neoprene spray skirt that holds your torso into the kayak. And I went to do it, and my back had been injured when I had the concussion, and my arms were paralyzed. So I was just hanging there like a rag doll and feeling like I was inside a washing machine. And my mind was just like thrashing like a fish in a bucket, like, please, 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 please. All of a sudden, I'm talking to God. I don't talk to God. I'm talking to God. I'm saying, anything, I'll do anything. Get me out of here. And then finally, I thought, I can't believe this is happening to me. I'm really dying. And I went away into a place that wasn't like a dream world because I couldn't see anything, but I could still hear a voice. And the voice said, "Do you want to live?" And I said, "Yes." And just as I said yes, it's like somebody turned a strobe on in a stadium. My eyes bolted open. I was back in the washing machine, and I had this painful tingling in my arms. And I groped forward, and I pulled the skirt off. And thank God I had a life preserver, because I would have drowned. The life preserver buoyed me, and I was at the surface wheezing and coughing water out of my lungs. So that yes was a passion for rescue. But that wasn't the mystery. The mystery was I'd already accepted I was dying. I'd already passed the point of no return. I was gone. And so when I thought about that yes, I thought, I didn't even think I could have a yes like that in me. I would never have believed it. And when I asked myself, what's the gist of that yes? The answer was this. It was, I'm not done yet. This isn't over. And when I look at that bucket chain of people working around the world to save our planet and to make it a more just place, I see a parallel yes. I see them working steadfastly, even though the odds suck at times. Even though the clock is ticking louder and louder on the issues, what I see is, we're not done yet, and this isn't over. So this is another piece of that bucket chain. These are some of the amazing people that I write about. I think of them as the faces of ocean country. They taught me that the heart of hope is a passion for rescue. That it's not about asking, is there hope? It's about asking, how can I become it? And when I look at this, I hear their voices. I hear Ansi Wahab say, we do this for our children. I hear Joanna Macy say, hope is something that you do. I hear Elizabeth Vallée, everyone has a role to play. And I hear Sergei Tadela when he said, we didn't quit. But if I were the woman I was 5 years ago, and I sat here tonight, and I heard this talk, I'd think, okay, this is a lovely talk. But these issues, climate change, mass extinction, they're too big, they're too systemic, and they are too enmeshed in our economy. And the woman I am today says, go to history for the answer. The anti-slavery movement, the women's rights movement, the civil rights movement, they all took on systemic issues that were completely enmeshed with our economy. And these movements are unfinished, but they have changed innumerable lives, and they have changed our world. So if there is one thing that I could offer you from everything that I have learned and seen and experienced, it would be this: that the equations by which we calculate our lives, by which we daily calculate whether there's success or failure, or hope or hopelessness, these equations have one critical corollary. And that corollary can be the difference between life or death, between a better future or a terribly degraded future, between saving a creature or losing it to extinction. And that corollary is, even if you can't do the math, don't quit. Thank you very much.
This is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight is Health and Hope from the Ocean Depths to the Mountain Tops. And you've just heard a wonderful speech from Liz Cunningham, author and environmental activist. It's now my pleasure to introduce Arlene Blum, Executive Director of Green Science Policy Institute. And Arlene will tell you about her experiences and her books. And here is Arlene.
Well, thank you. It's a privilege to follow Liz. And let's see, I'll see if I can get the slides to work. So I'm going to tell you about a climb of a mountain called Annapurna, which is the 10th highest mountain in the world. And it also is one of the most challenging to climb. My book, Annapurna, A Woman's Place, was published by Sierra Club Books in 1980. And unfortunately, Sierra Club Books went out of business, which is quite sad. All the wonderful exhibit format books by David Brower. And so my book, Annapurna, went out of print. But then a couple months ago, it was brought back by Counterpoint Press in Berkeley. And so Liz has a brand new book that she's told you about. Now I'm going to tell you about the reissue of Annapurna. And the title is Annapurna, Women's Place. But Annapurna, for me, is also a metaphor for work very similar in terms of reducing toxics for a healthier planet. And I always say the work I'm doing now is actually harder than climbing Annapurna, and I wouldn't be doing it if I hadn't done the mountain. So when the idea to climb Annapurna first came up in the 70s, all the world's highest mountains, 8,000 meters or higher, had been climbed by men, and not a single woman had climbed 8,000 meters, and people believed maybe women couldn't. I applied to go on an expedition and was told women could go as far as base camp and help with the cooking because they weren't strong enough or emotionally stable enough to climb high mountains. That was in the 70s, but we decided to attempt to do an all-women's climb of Annapurna. Our climbers at that point ranged in age from 20 to 50, and we're all still friends. We get together every year for reunions. We had to raise $80,000 to climb the mountain, and we raised it selling those T-shirts and saying a woman's place is on top. And and they're still available, actually. If you Google my name, arlenebloom.com, they're on our website. You can have your own T-shirt. So we went into Nepal during the monsoon rains and pitched our little tents down here at about 15,000 feet with the summit of 25,000. So it's about 2 vertical miles above, and carried heavy loads day after day to the high part of the mountain, which The first 8,000-meter peak ever climbed was Annapurna. It was climbed by a Frenchman named Maurice Herzog. Maybe some of you heard of that award-winning book, very popular. And so we thought, well, it was the first 8,000-meter peak climbed. It should be one of the easier and safer. Unfortunately, do you know what the most dangerous of all the 8,000-meter peaks is? Annapurna, and probably the hardest to climb. And the danger is from big avalanches that come down the slope. We did a route that we thought would be safer and easier up this ridge. To do that, we had to run past where the avalanches were. We thought we were safe on the ridge, but even that ridge felt the fury of avalanches. So anyway, just a few pictures of the beauty of Annapurna. And I have to say now, since I became a mom and my daughter is 28, I look at these pictures and think how beautiful, but I haven't really wanted to go there because of the danger. And the reason Annapurna is so dangerous is precipitation. It gets the most snowfall of any of the 8,000-meter peaks. This is a storm that buried all of our tents and everything halfway through the climb. And from that snow, you get huge avalanches. This cloud was like 2 miles wide. And directly in its path was our film crew, who miraculously the avalanche stopped just above them. In fact, at that point, I took this picture and watched these six spots disappear. And then the avalanche stopped, and I saw the six spots, which are people below me on the glacier, and thought, maybe we shouldn't be here. But we stayed and kept climbing, as you can see, very focused climbing a mountain like this. It's like where you put your hand or your foot determines if you live or die. So if any of you, I always have, you know, these voices in my head reminding me of the rude thing I said yesterday and the 17 things I have to do tomorrow. I don't know if anyone else has that constant monologue. And so when you're in a place like that, it shuts off all the voices and you have real focus. This is our camp three. We pitched our tents right there, and you can see you had to be really careful when you went out at night to go to the bathroom, not to end up at camp two. And just when it was really seeming cold and miserable, we heard a new sound, this honk, honk, up in the sky. And there were flocks of geese flying around the summit of Annapurna, migrating from Tibet to India. And that raised our spirits. And so this is now heading the summit team, and I went partway to take their pictures, and here they are on the top. This was the first women, the first Americans. We unfurled a Nepali flag, an American flag, held together by a Save the Whales pin. So we were thinking about the ocean up there. And the word went out. We were really happy. We'd accomplished what we'd intended to. And then we had a second summit bid. Two of our team wanted to do the first descent of the middle summit, and they never called on the radio from the high camp. We kept calling and calling, and they never reached the high camp. They fell to their death, and we don't know if it was an avalanche or a rock fall. And since then, all these years, virtually every team that goes to Annapurna loses somebody. It's an incredibly dangerous mountain. So we packed up huge, heavy loads, and we were here. I was carving on a memorial stone the name of the climbers who had died. At that point, 8 climbers had climbed Annapurna, and 9 had died trying. So it was a very, very dangerous mountain. So after Annapurna, I wrote the book, Annapurna, A Woman's Place, which the new edition that is for sale here has an introduction by a very famous climber and base jumper. And if you think climbing is foolhardy, base jumping is where you jump off cliffs with a parachute. Anyway, not for me. And then my more recent adventures, this is my daughter Annalise. I thought maybe she wouldn't like camping, and indeed she doesn't really, but when she was three to 6 months old and couldn't complain, we carried her across the Alps with baby from Yugoslavia to France. There she is in a little Gore-Tex baby suit, and this was the first baby backpacks were actually developed for Annalise. And here she is on her gap year, teaching English in Guatemala. She actually joined the poop group at Stanford as an undergraduate and works on sanitation and water in developing countries. She's an environmental engineer. She still doesn't like camping, but she wants to make the world a better place. I'm the proud mom. So I wrote another book, Breaking Trail, While Annalise was growing up, Annapurna took a year to write. Breaking Quail took 20 years. It was trying to figure out how I had a family that wouldn't let me ride horses or go to the beach because it was too dangerous in Chicago. And so how did I go from that to, you know, leading the Annapurna expedition? So it took about 20 years to write this book. And the last sentence of Breaking Trail. So right when Annalise started college, I'd finished the book. And I sort of wanted to go back to science, but I had stopped doing science, like to walk across the Himalayas in 1980. I hadn't done science for 26 years. So this was 2006. And so the last sentence of Breaking Trail is, the future is like an unbroken snow slope. I hope I can find a way to break trail to a more just and healthier world. But I was actually clueless what I was going to do. I thought maybe I can get a job in a lab washing test tubes. And but in any case, the last 9 years, that was 9 years ago, every day has been like being on Annapurna. Can you imagine? And it's about chemistry. Once you know chemistry, it's like riding a bicycle. It stays with you. So, let's see, where are we? And the issue, let me ask a question. How many of you think if a chemical is in your shampoo or your toothpaste or your chair, somebody in the government is making sure it's safe for your health? This is a very informed audience. But the reality is, no one is, because we have one law in the country called the Toxic Substances Control Act, and when it that regulates chemicals before they're out in the world. And when it passed, 62,000 chemicals were grandfathered, like, you're all okay. So asbestos, which kills about 10,000 people a year, the EPA tried to regulate and couldn't regulate. And then they gave up on all those chemicals. Now you say, wait, asbestos is regulated, we can't have asbestos. It's regulated in a very funny way. If a worker who's worked with asbestos gets a form of cancer called mesothelioma that's only caused by asbestos, they sue, they win, but they always die. And that's not a good way to regulate chemicals. So what has happened with this lack of regulation, it's like we're conducting a human study and we're the subjects because we're being exposed to all of these chemicals. They're said to be, what do we say in the last slide, nearly 80,000 chemicals about which there's almost no information, and we are the experimental subjects. So a group of us got together to talk about what could we be done, because 80,000 chemicals sounds really a lot, like what are you going to do? And we came up with six families of chemicals that contain most of the harmful chemicals. And people can learn about these families. And by people, I mean big companies, manufacturers, retailers, choose not to use them, and we can all be healthier. And that's the adventure we're on now. The class of chemicals that, the first one is fluorinated chemicals. Do people know that Scotchgard is one of the most harmful chemicals ever made? Did you know that? And it never breaks down. So the properties of this class of chemicals, it's the strongest bond in the periodic table, the carbon-fluorine bond. So these molecules are stain and water repellent, but they last for geologic time. That means a million years. So when you have your Gore-Tex jacket or your Teflon fry pan, the chemicals used to make that will be there a million years from now. There's no known breakdown products, and they are known to be toxic, sadly enough. Fluorochemicals are in lots of food contact papers. We did a study around Berkeley where we collected paper from food products, and if it repels grease, it probably has a fluorochemical. So some of the most organic restaurants in Berkeley, I won't say which, use these in their wrapping paper. All microwave popcorn pretty much has it. Lots of cosmetics, but it'll say fluoro on the label. It has to. A lot of outdoor gear. Just today, Greenpeace had a story on fluorochemicals in outdoor gear. Carpeting, if you say to a mom, well, you can have a really stain and water repellent carpet, but the chemicals are going to be in your baby for decades and on the planet for a million years, the mom may decide they don't need that carpet. So a lot of brands, the good news is all these brands are eliminating fluorinated chemicals, the whole class. So the class concept is you don't just stop using one bad chemical, you stop using the whole family. And I'll just say it's this class of chemicals never really got national publicity. We published a statement last May in Environmental Health Perspectives, signed by 230 scientists on the harm of this whole class of chemicals. And 2.5 weeks ago, the front page story in the New York Times Magazine, did anybody read that? It was a great story about fluorinated chemicals and talked about the Madrid Statement. And it's just funny, driving here, I got a call from what was it, ABC Morning News, that they want to do a story on this. And so this is the first time it's really coming to the national attention, which is great, because once people know, and I can just say, we've worked with IKEA for years, and IKEA a year ago decided they were taking these out from all their products worldwide, and they announced it. If anyone's really interested, February 10th, we have a meeting at Berkeley once a year. So IKEA announced it last February 10th that they were removing these chemicals from all their products worldwide. And if they needed this chemical and there was no substitute, they'd stop selling the product, which is pretty cool. And Kaiser was there in the audience. And Kaiser, about a week ago, announced they were eliminating this whole class from all their purchasing for all their hospitals. So that can happen. And a big furniture retailer, who doesn't want their name mentioned, but they were also at our February meeting last year and heard what IKEA had done. And they made a commitment. People make commitments at our meetings that July 1st, they stopped selling any fluorinated treatments for all their furniture. So you can find out what it was if you go to a furniture retail and they won't sell you a stain and water repellent. You'll know that's the one. The second class, antimicrobials. That's triclosan. It's a liquid in liquid soaps, Dial, Colgate Total toothpaste. It kills bacteria, but it's good to have bacteria on your hands. Soap and water is much healthier than using an antibacterial. And the problem, again, is triclosan doesn't break down in sewage treatment plants. So right now, 90% of American breast women have triclosan in their breast milk, which is not where you want it to be. And it's a water pollutant, and it doesn't provide a benefit. So it's used in many, many products. But when people know that, they can just stop using it. So flame retardants, so the story, my classic story, some of you, do you remember there were flame retardants in kids' pajamas in the 70s? Not bad ones. They were the really bad ones were removed way back in the 70s, and that was our work. We discovered that the flame retardant changed DNA. It was a mutagen, and that it went into the children. In America, foods, drugs, and pesticides, things that go into our mouths, are regulated, but other chemicals like flame retardants really aren't. So we wrote a paper back in Science. And this is what our institute does. We take scientific information and we make statements like the main flame retardant in children's pajamas is a mutagen and should not be used. If you read scientific papers, they mostly recommend more study. We made a specific recommendation back in the 70s, and 3 months later, Tris was banned from kids' pajamas. But the same Tris that was banned from kids' pajamas has been in our furniture, and that's My new story was back in 9 years ago when I decided I finished my book and wanted to go back to science. I went to a green chemistry meeting, met someone from the foam industry, and he said, "What do you do?" And I said, "Well, I used to do science 26 years ago. I did something with flame retardants." He said, "Flame retardants? We used to have this great flame retardant, Penta, but it turns out to be harmful, and now we have Tris. Do you think Tris is okay?" And I said, "Tris, are you kidding?" And but Penta, which was used in all our furniture pretty much, if anyone has a couch that they bought before 2005, 5% of the weight of the foam of your couch is a chemical called Penta. And because it was used for so long in so much furniture, we have human health results. You don't like having human health results. But women with higher levels of Penta take longer to get pregnant, and their children have a series of neurological impairments. It's been calculated the average California child has lost 4 or 5 IQ points from Penta in furniture, and there's no fire safety benefit. That is the crazy story. And when Penta was finally banned, the replacement was Tris, which, and both Penta and Tris are cancer-causing. And So the thing that changed everything, I had about 4 years of trying to tell the world about flame retardants, and at parties people would ask me what I do, and I'd start talking about flame retardants, and I'd see them, the tip got to go, and I'd see them talking to people on the other side of the room because I was such a bore. But it just sounded kind of like there couldn't be pounds of toxic chemicals in my couch. But then the Chicago Tribune did this incredible series. And this is the first front page story. A deceptive campaign by industry brought toxic flame retardants into our homes and our bodies, and the chemicals don't even work as promised. So this series was a finalist for the Pulitzer. It won every environmental journalism award. Dick Durbin, who was the majority whip from Illinois, became like me. Couldn't believe, you know, that everybody has this in their bodies and it doesn't even prevent fires. And then everything changed. And the real change is since January 1st, a year ago, flame retardants aren't needed. If you want to buy a couch, it will have a label. And the label will say contains flame retardants or contains no flame retardants. And according to the foam industry, they're not putting flame retardants in any furniture foam at all. We don't know what's coming in from China. So everybody can now buy furniture without flame retardants, which is a big deal. So if you want to learn more, we have a website, sixclasses.org. You can listen to a 15-minute lecture about these classes. And many major retailers and manufacturers have done this and made better choices. Target heard the lecture on antibacterials and removed them from their whole personal care line. So right now, we are working with the Buyers Club, who have purchasing tens of billions of dollars of purchasing together to move away from whole classes of harmful chemicals, particularly antibacterials, fluorinated chemicals, and flame retardants. And so I feel really optimistic. We have our six classes challenge that in 5 years to reduce by 50% the use of these chemicals. And they're a major cause of cancer, neurological impairments in our population. So it's something we can really do. Big purchasers, trade associations, big retailers. I'm going to be presenting this to the big retailers meeting, to Walmart and Target and Costco, at the end of February. And we're hoping that they'll do what IKEA has done and really choose. IKEA has basically phased out almost all these classes, and we're hoping the others will too, when they understand there's no benefit. There's a benefit to the chemical industry using them, but there's no benefit to manufacturers, retailers. Well, sometimes they have functions you need, but if you know how bad they are, you can make other choices. So if anybody wants to know more, I have mailing list signups. We send out emails once a month about this. Please leave a card or sign our mailing list, or you can go to our website. And I just want to end by saying, you know, that I think we can all work together and have hope for the ocean and really a healthier planet with less toxic chemicals by just getting educated and reducing the use of these classes. So I feel optimistic, and doesn't this sound like climbing Annapurna, but like more important? So thank you.
This is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight is Health and Hope from the Ocean Depths to the Mountaintops, with Liz Cunningham, author and environmental activist, and Arlene Blum, who you've just heard from, and a wonderful speech also, Executive Director, Green Science Policy Institute. We now come to that time in our audience when we have audience questions. And we do have a few questions. If you have some more questions for us, would you just kind of pass them down to the front here? That would be great. The first question we have for both our speakers, if they will address it, what is the most effective thing a regular person can do today to heal our oceans? Liz, would you like to comment first?
Well, one of them I think is very effective and also cheaper, and it's something that I've done, which is to eat, if you eat meat, to eat chicken instead of beef. Because the carbon imprint from producing beef is huge. It's 54 pounds of grain per 1 pound of beef, and it's 4 pounds of grain per 1 pound of chicken. And the chicken is cheaper. So it's amazing just doing that, because The oceans are absorbing an absolutely enormous quantity of carbon dioxide, and if we go on the track that we're on now, oysters are not going to be able to form their shells. I mean, it's going to be an absolutely catastrophic situation. But that one thing, which will save you a little money, can really help.
Arlene, same question in a way. What is most effective thing any one of us in the audience can do today or tomorrow on the areas that you have found so dangerous?
Well, the chemicals I'm talking about are called persistent organic pollutants, or POPs. And the highest levels in the world of these chemicals are actually in marine mammals, because they don't get taken out by sewage treatment plants, and the little creatures eat them, and then as you go up the marine food chain, it gets higher and higher. So the toxic flame retardants, the highest levels, are marine mammals off California. So actually reducing the use of, and I would say flame retardants, you know, stain repellents, antibacterials, all those end up at really high levels in marine mammals and all the creatures. You know, I always feel so sad, you know, for the bats, you know, the horrible white-nosed fungus that's decimating our bat population, the bees. Well, all those creatures, these persistent organic pollutants are in everything. Scotchgard is in every creature in the planet, and it's not helping their health. So by really reducing the use, you know, so do you really, I always say the question is, do you really need it, given the harm? So for example, extreme water repellency, maybe you need it when you climb Mount Everest, but we didn't have it when we climbed Annapurna. But do you need that in your surf shorts and your bathing suit? Virtually everything the outdoor industry sells is treated with these water repellents, and I don't think we really need it once we know the harm.
Actually, a similar question, but going to a different level, and that is, and I'll ask again to Liz and Arlene, what do you have any hope, that is really what it says, do you have any hope that the U.S. government and our people in Washington will come together to solve any of these problems, and which are the most important problems that you feel should be addressed? So, Arlene?
Oh, okay. Well, I actually do have lots of hope. We have been really successful working with government, though it's hard for government. So fortunately, flame retardants are not a partisan issue. You know, climate change is obviously the big issue, and it's ridiculously partisan. But toxics are a pretty big issue, too. If you change the DNA of creatures, and these chemicals do, that's long-term bad changes. And for things like flame retardants, they're there because of laws, and governments have to change the laws. And the government, I think with good science, governments are armed to be responsive and do what's needed. But for all those other chemicals, it's all about purchasers, and that can happen so fast. You know, Target overnight can say, we're not going to use antimicrobials anymore. So I think educating purchasers to avoid the most harmful chemicals, and the purchasers can be retailers, manufacturers, big companies, designers are really important. Whoever specifies what materials are in a product, if they're educated, can make healthier and safer choices. So I feel optimism, and I'm really glad that my issue is not partisan, because once it becomes partisan, we all know it's gridlock.
Liz?
Well, I have hope, because we live in a democracy. I mean, it's a sleepy democracy. But I think that many of us, even people who feel quite powerful and influential at times, feel that their voice doesn't matter. And I think one of the biggest changes that happened to me is that I started to realize, what if I really lived as if my voice mattered? And I think in our democracy now, when public outrage becomes sufficient, then the government will be forced to take more action.
Liz, this question is actually for you. What is your personal top priority now about health and hope?
You mean health and hope for the ocean?
For the ocean or any other area that you're really concerned about. But what are you actually targeting now to work with?
I think one of the things that I'm most interested in is the plight of people in the developing world. And for one reason was because I was so shocked.
I was so absolutely shocked how little I knew about it. And then when I returned to the United States, I was just so shocked how few people are paying attention to this issue. So I think the issue of sustainable seafood and the impact on what we're doing to the ocean, on the livelihoods of people in the developing world, is a great focus for me.
And actually, there was another similar question. Do you have an actual personal goal? It didn't say personal, but I added that in. But a personal action goal that you, the next thing you want to do is, somewhat similar to the experience you have, the next thing I want to do now is.
Well, actually, I want to go home and make cookies and watch Ratatouille with my husband.
I think that's a great response. Arlene, what's your next most prioritized hope?
How can I say that?
It can be anything. Cookies sound great. I think we would love to have cookies right now.
Well, okay, I'll get two. I mean, one is more skiing while the snow is so good. I just got back from Tahoe, backcountry skiing. But I really, and you know, I do feel sad, the environmental injustice of all these things, the people who are least responsible for the degradation of the ocean and for the products that are full of toxic chemicals are the people, indigenous people in the Arctic. Toxic chemicals go north and south, so the highest levels are in Arctic indigenous people who aren't responsible. So, you know, at least for me, I am pretty obsessed with what I call our six classes challenge to really reduce by 50%. And I think we can do that just by asking, is it really necessary? So, you know, finding, you know, I feel so like blessed to have, you know, just like I didn't know about eating chicken. I'm so glad to know about that. But that people, and people does mean big purchasers, corporations, and individuals can be educated, make better choices, and then everybody, including the indigenous folks, will be healthier. So that's kind of, in addition to skiing, that's my other obsession.
This is Ann Clark. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California, Health and Hope from the Ocean Depths to the Mountaintops, with Liz Cunningham, author and environmental activist, and Arlene Blum, Executive Director, Green Science Policy Institute. We thank all of you in the audience, and especially we want to recognize the wonderful work Arlene Blum and Liz Cunningham have done for all of us. This is really one of those programs in which we're touching on so many areas that are so critical and so much needed in terms of our focus and curing what's going on and making it better. So for Arlene and Liz, let's give them a big hand for their pioneering and sustainable work. Many thanks to our wonderful audience here tonight. We welcome you to the Commonwealth Club, and we hope you'll come back soon, and on the radio and on the internet. You can find our programs on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. Click on commonwealthclub.org for multimedia access to programs, current news feeds, streaming audio, radio schedules, our 230 radio stations on national radio networks, and our audio and video tapes, as well as free weekly podcasts and archive programs. Join us in February for these special programs from the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. Next Tuesday, February 2nd, Daniel Kamen, Rebecca Shirley, and Britt Shaw from UC Berkeley. They will discuss accelerating the clean energy revolution worldwide. And on Thursday, February 18th, after Super Bowl 50, we will have a program on the 49ers' LEED Gold environmental game-winning Levi's Stadium. So we will have a talk, a wonderful talk about the Levi's Stadium and how sustainable it is, with Jim Mercurio and Pat Rogan. And on Wednesday, February 24th, Francisco Vitor, San Francisco Foundation, and her work, Building Climate of Equality and Community. Francesca is also a commissioner on the San Francisco Public Utilities Commission. This is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources, member-led forum. Thank you so much for being with us tonight. And this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than 113 years of enlightened discussion in the know, is adjourned.